Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So France have faltered and England in line to add the Six Nations title to the Triple Crown following their win over Wales. But there's so much more to talk about, not least, when will the last round of matches, even if they will take place, when will they take place? What did you make of Joe Marler's tackle tickle? Was it right for Manu Tuilagi to see red? And what about the future of Eddie Jones after he admits there will be talks with the RFU in a couple of weeks? I'm Lawrence Dallaglio, and to provide all the answers, I'm joined by the Times top team of Owen Slott and Alex Lowe. Gentlemen, hello. Good morning.
Hello.
How are you both?
Very well, thank you, Lawrence.
Excellent,
How are you still with us? Lawrence is on a new diet.
Yeah, I'm doing intermittent fasting at the moment. I'm not sure if it's a good idea or not.
But well, 10 pints on, no pints off.
Yeah.
You don't seem to have wasted away quite yet, Lawrence. No, I don't know how much waste.
I think it's a bad idea when I'm not eating, and I think it's a really good idea when I am. But I'm giving it a go.
Is that why you weren't here last week? You just couldn't drag yourself out of bed.
It's probably 12 years too late. I don't know why I didn't do this fasting when I was actually playing. But
you're half the man you used to
be. There we are, in more ways. England were good value at the weekend, I thought. England 33, Wales 30. It's got a strange old look to it, that scoreline, isn't it? Because certainly didn't reflect the game, I don't think. But England deserved winners, despite a final 10 minutes of playing with 13 men. Let's just go straight to the decisions. I mean, it's a difficult game to referee, I suppose, but did the referee get the decisions right? I was working for ITV, and actually, as soon as I saw the tackle happen, I said straight away that he's going to be in trouble here, because you could see that George North sort of was lying prone on the floor. And actually, when I saw the first two angles, I gave him the benefit of the doubt and thought, oh, that's maybe a yellow card. But that when you saw the third angle, which was, you know, the obvious one, you realise that not only did he hit him in the head, whether he meant to or not, but actually, thankfully, he only glanced George North and didn't actually catch him full on. So I just think it's one of those that there was no malice necessarily, but you've got a responsibility to tackle and get your body height lower, I guess, when you're coming across.
I think one of the key things is that there was clearly no intent, but intent is no longer a consideration for the officials. It's the new framework is fact-based. Mm. And when you look at The only mitigation I thought live was the fact that he was dipping. But when you look at the directives, I think that's cancelled out by the fact that Manu should have had a clear view that that was going to happen. The fact he didn't was because he was leading with his shoulder, his right arm was tucked in, and he was hurtling himself at George North. There was no intent ever to make a legal tackle.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I don't think there was any option but to show a red card.
Yeah, agreed.
I think Manu responded as if he knew that he was going to get a red. He didn't object. He didn't look like he was hard done by. He apologised immediately. Yeah. Again, I think it's one of those ones that's very, very public in front of 7 million whatever TV viewers. It's almost good that people see that you can't do that, and people learn
Ben Young said afterwards exactly the same. He said, I've got no qualms with that red card. Manu's got no qualms with it. Yeah. we know it was wrong, which he said downstairs at Twickenham, while upstairs, Eddie Jones was ranting and raving about what a ridiculous decision it was.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think that the shame for Manu Tuilagi is he actually had another very, very productive game for England. Yeah. I thought, particularly in the first half, he was a strong ball carrier and played very well. And it was a bit of a blemish on what was a good performance.
It was a blemish, but I think it seems like we're all slightly agreeing that we slightly empathise with him because, as you say, there was no malice, there was no intent. He made a mistake. He put his hand up, so sorry. He got a big punishment for it. I mean, it was in the 74th minute, so it didn't. Well, I mean, it nearly did.
I can't quite work out how players throw themselves without. Well, I mean, why don't you just go with your arms? I mean, you know, there was already a chop tackle in progress. I don't think George North would have scored anyway.
So my question, Lawrence,
and I don't understand if you just when you're cover tackling, and I've done it quite a bit, just lead with your arms. I mean, is that not what you're taught to do?
Well, yeah, I always lead with my arms.
I don't quite know what Eddie's argument was on that. He said it was never a red card because Manu was just going in to kill the tackle, but he went in and, you know, clocked George North's head with his shoulder.
Well, I think what Eddie hasn't done is he hasn't necessarily read the directives, because if you read the directives, you know, there's, you know, mitigation is not there. Yeah. Even if a player's falling, the referee was very clear. He said there's no mitigation there. You know, this is it's facts now.
But what does it say about England rugby? Or what does it say about rugby? What message is if the England coach, the highest profile bloke in the game in this country, is doing that after a game? I mean, one, it was unnecessary, and two, I haven't seen anyone who agrees with anything he said.
The uproar at the World Cup when Michael Checker took exactly the same stance, and there wasn't even a red card for Reece Hodge in the Fiji game, but that should have been a red at the time. He got a three-game ban afterwards, and Checker was ranting and raving about that, and it was a nailed-on red card.
Just moving to the other incident, Alex, what do we make of the Joe Marler incident, and looks like he might end up, you know, getting quite a long ban. I mean, just for what it's worth, I mean, obviously there's no place for that. I think he, you know, whether it was a bit of humour to try and break up a bit of a scuffle, you can't do those sorts of things, whether it's fun or not.
Wasn't it just provocation? Was he not trying to get a rise?
Yes, although, you know, listen, there's different ways of provocation, isn't there? And Alan Wynne-Jones was certainly guilty of provocation to Carl Sinclair in the fixture last year. So it just didn't do it in perhaps the same way as Joe Marler. And I'm not condoning what Joe Marler did, but I have to say I was surprised by the reaction of Alan Wynne-Jones post-match. They're both Lions. One was his captain, one was a player. Clearly, they didn't get on that well, because you don't throw a player under the bus in the way that Alan Wynne-Jones has after the game by the comments, because, you know, he's one of the most respected, quite rightly, one of the most respected men in world rugby, Alan Wynne-Jones. And what he said has set the tone now for the disciplinary hearing for Joe Marler. And I would be very, very surprised if he doesn't now not get a lengthy, lengthy ban. And I don't, you know, I mean, it'd be interesting to see, you know, what happens at the back of it. I'm not, as I said, I'm not condoning it, but equally, Alan Wynne-Jones spoke like a man who's lost three games on the trot, was disappointed with his own team's performance, and I just didn't expect him to throw Joe Marler under the bus way.
To get that long ban, so the laws say that to get a 12-week ban, you grab, twist, or squeeze the opponent's testicles
rather than cup or tickle.
Well, it was just it was a very friendly affair, wasn't it, in that respect? Yeah. So, I mean, I would just love to be in that judiciary panel when they're discussing, you know, does Alan Wynne have to go in and say exactly how much, you know, what he felt and how tickly it was, or whether it was a bit squeezy or a bit twisty, or.
But I mean, going back to your point, it's provocation.
It's got to be provocation, rather. It's not funny,
but
is
it's
it?
I mean, no, it's not funny. But there's also different ways of provocating, and as I said, all players are guilty of it, you know, in different ways. And you know, we've seen it with the likes of Ellis Genge being targeted. We've seen it with the likes of Carl Sinclair being targeted. I'm not sure you're ever going to get provocation out of Alan Wynne-Jones. He's a fairly calm individual on the rugby field, and handled, if I can use that word, that situation rather well, I thought.
I think Joe Marler, one of our colleagues spotted in the Harlequins documentary that the BBC made, there's a scene in it when Harlequins are in their change room celebrating a victory. Alex Donbrandt's on the table, having beer sprayed all over him. And then up to him walks Joe Marler, who gives him the same greeting that he gave to Alan Wynne-Jones. It's clearly something that Joe does to get a rise, to be funny. I just think it was inappropriate on a test rugby field. I don't think the regulations were written for that specific incident, as
exactly.
we said.
Exactly, yeah, that's the point. They were, that's the point.
They're not written for
an aggressive act.
Yeah. I mean, the Exeter Chiefs, you know, the Exeter Chiefs players seem to sort of greet their own players with that every time they score
and
a try.
It has provoked a level of hysteria in some quarters.
More than the punch that was thrown by the French tight end who was sent off. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, the disciplinary hearings in both.
Raising questions about, you know, what would your boss say if you did that to him in your office? And those comparisons aren't helpful, because a rugby environment, a rugby field, a rugby club is a different environment to an office.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Joe Marler moving forward, because I would probably imagine that Ellis Genge was in line to win his first start. Is it his first start for England?
He has started, but
he certainly would, in my mind, start against Italy. Yeah. You know, even though Joe Marler's been playing outstandingly well, you know, he may well end up with a ban. And having got himself back into international rugby and playing superbly, he may well decide that enough is enough.
There was a sense over the weekend that this could be it for Joe Marler as an England player, and which I feel, this incident aside, I'd be disappointed and surprised if he made that call, because I think he's worked himself into a position where he's England's first choice loose head prop. Yeah. Ellis Genge might well start against Italy, but that says more about the opposition than it does about the hierarchy of England loose heads. Yeah. And he's, you know, $25,000 a week on the table to be England's starting loose head prop. He wants to win something. I'd be disappointed if he called it a day, particularly if it was anything related to what happened.
Looks like another player that might have called it a day, particularly at Twickenham, is George Cruz, because certainly by the way he left the field, you know, with a bit of a wave to the crowd. The rumours about him accepting that rather lucrative contract in Japan, and with everything that's going on at Saracens, may well be true.
Do you think people won't realise how important he is until he's in Japan and not playing for England?
Yeah, I think you're right. Although, you know, in many ways, it might change the picture in the back row, which is no bad thing. Yeah. You know, you've got Courtney Laws, world-class player, again, magnificent on Saturday. Joe Launchbury, you know, looked pretty effective when he came on. Charlie Yules, I think there's so many good second rows. Mm. Maybe not quite at the level of Cruz, but certainly can get there for sure. And then it'll change the dynamic of who's selecting the back row.
I talked to Cruz after the game and was saying, you know, when you were waving, it looked like you were waving goodbye. And he's obviously not in a position where he can confirm what his plans are. But the way he was talking, he was sort of suggesting that maybe he could still, that maybe there was a way of playing for England and he could still get some get that nice Japan contract at the same time.
Yeah, so, I mean, listen,
I'm not sure how you would juggle that, because we all know what that sort of rule is.
Well, I think you juggle it by going to Japan for a year and then coming back again and then fighting for your place again. Haskell's done it. Yeah, there's one or two players
But Haskell was quite young when he left, wasn't he? So Haskell sort of went on a development sort of year off, didn't he?
Yeah. One man who is certainly not retiring at the moment, or is he, is Eddie Jones. He claimed that it was 16-13 by the end of the game, which, well, we can talk about that. But also, could this be the end of the Eddie Jones era, or is it the start of a new Eddie Jones era? Owen, you've ran the piece on the back of the Times. Jones in talks over future England head coach to meet the RFU Chiefs. He said something, Alex, on Saturday night that he was keeping the Triple Crown trophy and he wasn't going to give it to the RFU until they brought him to the table. Well, I mean, that's the kind of veiled, veiled kind of...
He said he'd be taking the Triple Crown shield to plate to dinner with Bill Sweeney, presumably as a way of persuading the chief exec to give him a new deal. That was the inference.
I'm not sure that bringing a Triple Crown is going to be quite the deciding. Look what I've got.
Let's talk about this.
A World Cup or a Grand Slam might have done
it. Just quickly, because when Bill Sweeney, the CEO of the RFU, took over, he England were on the verge of winning the World Cup, and he got very excited and said that, you know, he wanted to secure Eddie Jones for another 4 years. Since then, he sort of backtracked slightly, and after England lost the Rugby World Cup final, and said that that maybe that's not necessarily the move, and then it's probably gone a bit quiet, and Eddie Jones, understandably, is getting a bit frustrated because he doesn't know where the future lies, really.
I don't think it's very good for anyone having uncertainty in that position. I don't think it's very good for the players. They want to know what they're playing for, and I don't think it's that good for the development of the team, because we don't know, is Eddie playing for this year or next year, or has he got, you know, to what extent has he got a long-term 4-year plan that he's operating on?
But Razzy Erasmus has shown everyone, and
that
South Africa have shown everyone, that the World Cup is not a four-year cycle necessarily, although it's often the best way to approach it. But I think that's probably changed Bill Sweeney's thinking. And if they are going to make a change, then you can still make a change after 2 years and have an impact, I guess. But works for South Africa may not work for England.
The weird thing about this is that it's been a topic of conversation since Eddie won the Grand Slam in his first year. And then all because, and it's unsurprisingly, the RFU's communications about it have been a complete shambles. Mm. Like, they gave him the deal in 2016 and explicitly said that he would be bringing through the next coach who'd take over after the next World Cup. So they created the situation. Then they gave Eddie an extension because they didn't have anyone in place to take over after the next World Cup. So then on the day after the final, Bill Sweeney says, you've got to look at this as a four-year thing. You know, it would make perfect sense to give him a deal through to 2023. A month later, he says, well, actually, Razzy Erasmus won it in 2 years. So that's not... Like, no other country has had a running commentary on the future of their national coach, apart from England, and all because the RFU keep changing their mind about what they're going to do.
Well, I suppose if you're not going to give someone a deal, and I'm not here suggesting that they shouldn't, but if you're not going to, you do need something in place for what you are going to do. As I understand it, England haven't been speaking or seeking out any other...
Succession planning has not been a strength.
Well,
succession
planning has never been a strength for English rugby,
which
is why we won one
really
Six Nations title in 12 years post-Rugby World Cup, which, quite frankly, is... A disgrace.
Okay, so here's one way of looking at the Eddie thing. So what you're asking is, for me, there's two questions. One is, do you think that he can take that team and be successful at the World Cup? So the way things are at the moment, I would say, bit black and white, I'd say probably yes. I think the team did well at the World Cup, messed up at the end, but seems to be moving on still. And you can see the development in it. You can see how it gets stronger. And I think the players still really like playing for him. So I would say on the whole... Yes. So would you therefore not keep on Eddie Jones because of all the nonsense and the drama and the pantomime that goes with it and that often doesn't paint rugby and England rugby in a good light?
I would agree with you. I would say, give him a new deal till the World Cup, but start planning now for who's going to take over post-World Cup as well. And I don't think, you sit down with him and say, we're going to do that, just so you're clear, because it's not going to be you, whether you win it or not. And we would like to, start planning that now, because you can't suddenly find these guys to take over overnight. 2 years is about the right time to plan it. So,
in my mind, they've got one decision to make.
Yeah.
Do they want Warren Gatland to take over after the Lions tour, or do they want Eddie Jones to stay on to the World Cup? And they make that decision now and then make that appointment now.
Would you chase Gatland now? Would you be on the plane to New Zealand saying...
I'd want to talk to him, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I'd want to talk to him.
Yeah, and if not him, then, it's Eddie Jones' job for sure.
Yeah.
But I would still be speaking to people now for 2 years' time, because I don't think you can start having those conversations. But be very open and honest with Eddie about it. You've got to start thinking about the future. Can't suddenly get to 6 months before the World Cup in Paris and say, oh, who's going to coach England after the World Cup? Life doesn't work like that.
And Lawrence, therefore... what do you think of someone who knows Warren Gatland pretty well? He's doing the Lions, and then he's contracted for another year with the Chiefs after that. So really, you'd say he's in Polish position for the next All Blacks job. So would he compromise his All Black future if he really wants that for a dabble with England?
I think it depends on what Trudy Gatland wants, really, rather than what Warren Gatland wants, like it does with most people. I think she spent a lot of time travelling the world. Warren's now back in New Zealand with the Waikato Chiefs. He's going to do the Lions job.
He lives at home.
He's spending more time with his family, which he hasn't done over the number of years. I'd be surprised, having already said no to England, having said that he won't coach England to the Welsh public, I would be surprised if he does. If you look at the track record of most Welsh coaches, Graham Henry, coach Wales, Steve Hansen, coach Wales, Warren Gatland, coach Wales, what they've done is they've gone back and they've had a shot at coaching the All Blacks.
I'd be surprised too, but I'm just saying, if I was the RFU, I think
that's a good shout.
They've got two choices here. I think they either give Eddie the extension and end this conversation, and the only, for me, the only viable alternative is Warren Gatland. Particularly, yeah. I mean, Razzy Erasmus would have been an interesting conversation, but he's just signed a new contract, which probably has a few zeros put on it. After
I think
the
people's estimations of Warren Gatland, particularly in New Zealand, would have changed after the Lions tour to New Zealand, because what he had to deal with and how he coped with that situation, I think he came out of that tour back home with enormous credit.
And he's also already sort of earning rave reviews as the Chiefs coach.
Yeah, he's doing well. So, yeah, I'll be surprised if they do that. But
do you have Trudy Gatland's number? Maybe we could give her a ring and settle this whole debate here and now.
I bet
you do.
All I'm saying is these decisions are not just based on what one person wants, are they? They're based on what the wife wants generally. Happy wife, happy life. That's the way it works.
Thanks for that life tip, Lawrence.
I'll go home
and try and put it into action.
It's your wife's
never
birthday.
Never thought of it
today.
Like that. Yeah, happy birthday.
What do we think about Wales? Because they've lost three games now. Lots of different ideas. They've got Sam Warburton in there as a breakdown coach. They're clearly missing Sean Edwards. Yeah. You can't not say that. And that's quite understandable. Other coaches are coming in trying to put their kind of ideas and personality to the fore. And also that they've had their tough games away, they've had tough games away from home. Ireland was always going to be a struggle after what they did to them last year. And I think England at Twickenham is always tricky for them. So, you know, how do we assess Wales? Did they get their team selection right? Did they get their tactics right?
Not dissimilar to how they played against Australia. They knew what Wales were going to do. Wales are sitting out their stall to evolve the way they want to play. You see the number of times they were running it from deep. Talk about team selection, I thought the recruitment of Nick Tompkins has been one of the highlights of this championship, because he was superb.
I was very close to naming him man of the match, or player
he was superb,
of the match. I just couldn't quite bring myself to do that when England were comfortable winners, really.
We can see, I mean, I think Eddie Jones was actually quite generous towards them after the game, and I thought he was right. We can see what Wayne Pivac is trying to evolve the team into becoming. I couldn't help feel but watch them and think that they were, if they could evolve that attacking game with Sean Edwards still running the defence, they'd have been in a much better, much stronger place to do it. They're in a transition at the moment. I think, as Eddie pointed out, 800 odd caps. There are going to be players that have to come through. Pivac is trying to change the way they play, and it's very hard to do that overnight. I mean, it's easier to install a discipline as Sean Edwards. It's easier to do what Sean Edwards has done with France than what Wayne Pivac is trying to do with Wales.
Yeah.
That takes longer.
I've not been a defence coach for a while, to be honest with you. So my question on this Wales thing is it's been amazing how you take Sean Edwards out of that equation and the change there is.
Yeah.
Basically
Sean Edwards was all about a blitz defence, rush defence,
yeah,
from out to in, and trying to turn the England runners back on the inside, and also they attacked the breakdown a lot more. If you look at, maybe it was a personnel thing, but when you had Sam Warburton, when you had a number of other Tipperick, they got a lot more turnovers against England.
So what
they're not doing with Byron Haywood, they're not doing that out to in defence. It's a slight change. They're allowing England the opportunity to get the ball with a bit more width and attacking them out wide. So
that's what I'm saying. So you take Sean Edwards out and you put him into France, and you say, okay, you can see that he's made an immediate impact on France. But when you take him out of Wales, given that we know what impact and how successful he was, why would you change so much of what he did? If you're the incoming defence coach, I can understand making decisions about what ruck ball you're going to challenge and what you're not. But that fast blitz defence, why would you toy with it? Would you not just say that's our template and we don't want to change it?
Yeah, I think personally you make changes, but you do it over a longer period of time. I think it's quite difficult to make change. Well, if you make changes immediately, you're going to have the results you have, because there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be misreads, there's going to be, which is what happened at the weekend, you're going to get mistakes being made. So, yeah, I do understand that. But, new people want to put their stamp on things. Sam Warburton, there's no doubt he has a lot of value to add to that team.
Definitely.
But clearly he's getting his players to be a bit more selective about the breakdowns that they try and go in and attack, which is why Wales didn't actually have that much success there at the weekend. So, I agree with you. Change for the sake of change is unimportant. You've got to remember they are missing their defensive captain, Jonathan Davis, who I think is massively important to Sean Edwards and to what Wales did last season. So,
I think that's one thing we have learnt about Wales is that they don't really have a strength in depth that can match England. You take Jonathan Davis out and they look fallible. I think their front row is a development thing, whereas England just seem to have you know, a new prop ready to go all the time, don't they?
Well, listen, Sunday Times rugby correspondent and, of course, Ruck regular Stephen Jones can't be with us today, but he has sent us his thoughts on Saturday's game and what next for Wales.
Hi Lawrence, hi guys, I'm sorry I can't be with you today. I'm on a top secret mission. Indeed, it's so secret that I don't know what it is. There's no question whatsoever in my mind that England will win the title now. I'm sure you agree. Amazing, perhaps, when you consider how average they were in Paris at the start. And in fact, probably proof that there are no great sides this year. England may end the best of the bunch and are finishing stronger, but we've all seen a host of better England teams as well. They look to be giving half a great performance all the time, but never much more than that, although at the moment, way out ahead of the others. And Wales, Italy, Scotland, Ireland all look like transitional teams after a World Cup, and actually transitioning quite slowly. It's possible that Wales have dropped off the most. What disturbed me a little was the way that they were set up to play and the way they played. They didn't pick their biggest and hardest pack, which is surely a prerequisite. To leave out Tolupi Faletau and Gareth Davis for the occasion, just unfathomable for me. And Thomas Williams at scrum half, for instance, is a lovely player, but really, in international rugby these days, you need the hard nuts, you need the physicality, and Gareth Davis is certainly a physical player and the best for the bunch in Wales. Jonathan Davis said that Wales tried to play expansive rugby regardless of the quality of ball they got, which is quite true. And the first half alone, they looked like a small schoolboy team playing touch rugby, popping the passes along the line and really ending up crunched in the jaws of the England defence, which was excellent. And it was Eddie Ball in full, uncompromising form, driving the ball up, strong in the set piece, relentless on the defensive line and on the attacking line. Take your chances, kick your goals, win the game. And in fact, they did win it by more than the final score suggests. There's no doubt about that. On Saturday against Scotland, Faletau must be back. Davies must be back. I think they probably need a big centre. And Dan Biggar, the great Dan Biggar, and I'm using the word great advisedly, deserves better people around him. I just thought he was absolutely fantastic and the man of the match on Saturday. Wales people should stop looking for a twinkle toes Phil Bennett. This is the real world, and Dan Biggar is very much in the real world. Elsewhere, Wales were not good enough at prop, and they haven't been for a long time. They're cruelly missing Thomas Francis, of course. And it's time, I think, now to stop playing undersized props. I didn't think either of the Welsh props contributed up front and not around the field, whereas you see people like Carl Sinclair, Joe Marler, Michael Vunipola really involved in the rest of the game. And even though I'm never really fond of playing the youth card, I think Rhys Carey and Leon Brown, who did come on as replacements on Saturday, must start against Scotland. They must be put on the fastest of fast tracks because they both have monster size and they both have real ability. Carey will be fine at Saracens because the fast track there is as good as anywhere in world rugby. Leon Brown of the Dragons has been cruelly hampered by injury, but he is a big man. At the moment, his scrummaging is way underpowered. Wales should consider finding a professor of scrummaging wherever there's one free around the world, France, Argentina, Georgia, anywhere. And they should send Brown there for 2 months or 3 months to come back like the aggressive monster up front that he can be around the field. But they should even consider playing Carey and Brown against Scotland on Saturday to keep them on that fast track and to get them moving, because Wales have a heritage of great forward play. At the moment, I thought Ken Owens looked like he was on his own in the scrum. And finally, for Wayne Pivac, they did look like a team playing like Llanelli used to play under Pivac. that is in a weak league in a totally different context. It will not happen in the international arena. And no pressure on Pivac. He's a decent guy, a very fine coach. He'll work it out. But he was off on the wrong foot, no doubt about it.
So let's look at the Scotland game. Scotland 28, France 17. No Grand Slam for the young French team. Once again, let down by that ill discipline. So, if we excuse the pun, it gives England a fighting chance to pick up the Six Nations title, whenever that may well be. And Ireland, of course, they're not to be discounted at this stage. But good performance from Scotland. They needed that under Gregor Townsend, you felt. They've been under pressure, particularly with Finn Russell outside the squad. And I'm not entirely surprised by the French losing. They didn't quite look at it right from the start of the game. I don't know what it is. I mean, they're still learning, aren't they, really? And Ibanez was gracious enough to say, you know, that Scotland deserved to win. And this French team, maybe the results in the first three rounds have made everyone look at them perhaps a little bit more, praise them a little bit higher than they should have been praised, and maybe we shouldn't be quick to criticise them just because they...
Isn't that a sign of just a young team who can click and look really absolutely brilliant, you know, on and off, but it takes time to build a team that's strong for every battle, that's, you know, that knows how to win in different circumstances.
100%. And it takes time to build a squad because it's not just a team. You know, Romain Ntamack, who's been, you know, the star of the show along with Antoine Dupont, they lose him to concussion early in the game. You know, have they got the ability to, you know, do what England do and just put George Ford in there or Owen Farrell in, you know what I mean? So, yeah. And Dupont, I thought, was targeted cleverly because he's been a star. The Scotland sort of, you know, they put pressure through the breakdown. They got to him. They made them make mistakes and made them look a bit more flustered. And as you say, it takes time to recover.
Them, didn't they?
And there is a question mark over their fitness again as well, France. And I think, as we saw in the last 10 minutes when Tuilagi got sent off, you know, France had to cope with a whole 40 minutes of rugby with 14 men. Yeah. And I'm not sure, well, one, they're able to do that, but also I'm not sure they're fit enough to do that either yet.
The thing about international rugby is you get, because there's so few games, you get such little time to get it together and get it to work. I mean, in the club season, you can have these fluctuations and you can have two or three games where it's not going quite so well. And then you can bottom out and people aren't saying that it's a disaster or it's fantastic. But international rugby, you know, Scotland have been ticking along, not quite hitting their stride. And now they get it right. And actually quite a lot of people are saying how good they've been this season and how unlucky they've been. And I don't know, it's a cliche, but margins, you know, a few things click into place and they look quite good.
Yeah, and I think it still tells us that it's hard. You know, those away wins, particularly in the Six Nations, are a precious commodity, aren't they? If you can go and grind out a win away from home, you know, as France did in Cardiff, you know, it's a tough thing to do, as England did up at Murrayfield. No matter how they got there, they got over the line. Not easy winning away from home, particularly. Not easy getting anywhere at the moment with coronavirus. What's the latest, Alex?
Yeah, it's been a morning of breaking news. On the France front, Rafael Ibanez, the France team manager, just as we've been talking, has claimed that Aouas had been gouged by Nick Haining just before he threw his punch. So that's clearly the defence that they're going to be putting forward at the disciplinary hearing.
And that's Aouas, the French prop who was sent off.
French prop who was sent off.
No issues with that. I mean, you know, quite why anyone would throw a right-hander now is in rugby. He is captured brilliantly by Dave Rogers.
Yeah, what a picture from
wonderful
Dave.
Photo on the back of the Times. I mean, that is, yeah, that's fantastic bit of photography.
Can we have Dave as God of the Week? I know it's a bit early.
Yeah, no. You've gone already. I mean, are you out the reckoning yourself this week, then, Owen?
Well, I'm back from my suspension on the back of that.
And the other news that's emerging is that it sounds like all Six Nations matches this coming weekend will be postponed. They're going to play the final round on October the 31st. So Super Saturday will be postponed till October the 31st. Presumably Ireland and Italy will have to be before that, but news is just still filtering through, which for England will make it a 5-test autumn, and they'll go to Italy the week before they play the All Blacks at Twickenham. And the way that the results have gone, that there'll be a race to the title on that day, which so we will get the climax to the Six Nations that we all wanted just 6 months later than was originally planned.
Well, as you say, that gives us that exciting climax so that this tournament has sort of in its uncertain way been building to.
Yeah, I do think privately the Six Nations officials would have loved Scotland winning yesterday because it creates a real sense of jeopardy going into that last
game. Yeah, you've got England top of the table on points difference. You know, France with Ireland at home, still everything to play for. And Ireland themselves, two games left, and they're certainly not out of it. So that three-way Super Saturday will just have to be in the autumn, which will be a little bit strange, really. But this coronavirus could well affect, you know, domestic and European rugby. I mean, there's lots to be decided. Travelling is obviously the key one. You know, we've got European Champions Cup matches not that far away. Ireland have already cancelled the Italians coming over to Dublin. You know, we've got Leinster against Saracens. You know, how does that kind of thing look? I guess, you know, what we have to remember is it's a pretty serious issue. There's people dying.
How many England fans do you reckon will be in Rome this coming weekend who've bought their weekend?
I think
away?
The Italian situation is a bit different because, you know, clearly there's a real outbreak of the coronavirus there.
But so. Rome's not near Lombardy, is it?
No, it's not.
I mean, I'm speaking to an Italian when I say that, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, Lawrence.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it depends what your age profile is and how your immune system is. Word Italy is enough to cause a bit of panic in people's minds at the moment.
Yeah. I know. I do know some people who bought flights from Stansted, which were costing over £1,000 for two, but because there's no government advice saying don't go to Rome, they can't get their money back on the flights.
Listen, it wouldn't be a Ruck podcast without Jones Moans. That wasn't a segue from coronavirus into Stephen Jones, although it possibly was. Yeah. And the great man is worried England's dominance of the women's Six Nations is bad for the game after another 10-try romp against Wales at the Stoop.
One bad result on Saturday, and it was England's win by 60-odd points over Wales in the Women's International in Cardiff. I'm sorry, but that cannot go on. In a way, it looked like England could have reached 100 had they needed to. No blame on the Welsh girls. They're amateurs. They're too young. Wales always have got this thing of bringing in youth for the future. Well, when you do that, you haven't got a present, and the future tends to fade before your eyes. And I think it's now time to work out that the Six Nations should be disbanded for the women until such time as six teams of equal quality can play. And there are many, many different schemes you can put in place to have that desired result.
So Stephen Jones pretty adamant there that there should be a rethink on the women's Six Nations. I mean, it's a familiar argument, particularly with the women, it's Wales that are the problem. With the men, it's Italy that are the problem. You know, there's no easy solutions, is there? Because it's such a great tournament. You can't just go back to five. You're trying to develop, you know, the likes of Wales in the women's game, Italy in the men's game. You know, do you have promotion and relegation? I don't know. I mean, is there an easy solution that we can think of?
I think the women's Six Nations is not so set in stone as the men, and I think there's clearly two much stronger teams, and I think probably you could grasp that nettle and do something with it sooner rather than just let it go on because it's the Six Nations. I mean,
yes.
I think we've talked about before moving it away from the men's competition so it gets more visibility, which I think would be a great thing. And I don't know what they should do, but the other really good international team is the New Zealand women's team. So could they come up and be part of an annual competition and maybe have two tiers? Something like that would work better.
Do you think Wales struggle resource wise? So they're putting all their money into the men's game, and therefore, you know, they need a bit of an olive branch with World Rugby to actually fund that, to help them fund the women's game.
And I was thinking if you couldn't. They seem pretty wedded. The authorities seem pretty wedded to Women's Six Nations. The chief exec was talking before the tournament began about, as Owen says, about moving it into its own window, getting it a title sponsor, a single, maybe an aligned TV deal with the men, so that everyone knows where all the matches are on the same channel. Now, if they can generate funds for it, then that's critical. I like the idea of having a sort of a triangular tournament every year with the three best teams. I think that would work, but if ultimately you want a Women's Six Nations, which clearly we do, then resources have to be generated somehow to allow Wales and Scotland and the other nations to go professional, because that's the difference.
Just want to switch our attentions to domestic rugby with the Gallagher Premiership. Bristol and Sale continue to show us all that they're serious threat this season to Exeter Wasps. You know, post-Di Young, you know, another bonus point, another five tries. They seem to be really picking things up. And Gloucester, what has happened to Gloucester?
The turnaround of Wasps has been the really eye-catching thing in the last 3 weeks. I mean, you'd know sort of what's happened there, and I guess what's happened is it just completely endorsed the decision that was made to have a change at the top.
Yeah, I think it was just showed that they were ready for a change. Clearly, there's a lot of players there who have and coaches that have suddenly felt, for whatever reason, that the shackles are off. And yeah, you know, three bonus point wins on the trot, and it's incredible, really, because they've gone from 11th a few weeks ago to now 5th, and they play the team, Northampton, who are 4th in a couple of weeks. So other than Exeter, actually, everyone else is in the mix, really, in terms of there's still 9 rounds of Premiership rugby to go. I guess the only team that are in free fall at the moment are Gloucester and, to a certain extent, Harlequins, but they've got a bit of mitigation because they've got a massive injury list.
Lawrence, Lee Blackett, who is the, I don't know what you're calling him, he's the main man at the moment. He's picking Jacob Umaga as his 10 ahead of Sopawanga, who played 15 at the weekend. Mm. I mean, is Umaga that outstanding? I mean,
I think a bit of both, really. Umaga has been outstanding, which is why Eddie Jones picked him in the squad ahead of a number of other
Marcus Smith
players like Marcus Smith. But he's been very, very good. Equally, Sopawanga, for whatever reason, has been disappointing through loss of form and injury.
But he played better at the weekend.
And, you know, Wasps maybe under Dai Young, for whatever reason, they lost their way a little bit, lost a few of their core players, like your Cipriani's and your Haskells, who have been there a long time. Then they went, you know, for the likes of Brad Shields and Sopawanga, which haven't necessarily, for whatever reason, and I'm not blaming the individuals, worked out in the same way as either of they or the fans would want. So,
but are those players, are they not coming over the last 3 weeks? Have they not looked a bit?
Yeah, they have. I mean, Brad Shields played, you know, magnificently well, and so is Sopawanga. So, you know, things are starting to come together there. You know, they've got a core of players, the likes of Jack Willis, again, outstanding at the weekend, and he'll be pushing the door again for Eddie Jones, I'm sure. So, things are much happier at Wasps. As I said, Gloucester seem to be in free fall, not quite sure what's going on there. And I guess Sale are the team that are now... Sale and Bristol, I think, are the big talking points, really, because, I mean, Bristol have got a seriously good team. No one's suggesting that they can win the title just yet. But when you look at the likes of the two Saracen, Malins is going there.
Ben Earl,
Rodrada.
Carl Sinclair.
I mean, you know, there's going to be some serious... I mean, with that sort of cavalry also comes selection issues and problems, and you've got to balance your squad and get the right... But they're nice problems to have. So Pat Lamb doing an excellent job. And Sale, you know, under Steve Diamond, they've got the Premiership Cup final next week at the AJ Bell where they play Quins. You've got to say on form, you'd fancy them.
One thing you can say about Sale is they've got this far, but Diaga hasn't really made an impression yet, and Mark Wilson's only really like a new player. Yeah. I mean, those are two World Cup finalists who is effectively fresh off the bench.
Yeah, I have to say I could see them winning the title this year. If not Exeter, I could see them winning, or Bristol.
Okay, just one question. Would it be good? What would it say about English rugby? Sale win the Premiership, having bought half of South Africa with them?
Well, it's not bought half of South Africa. They've spent wisely, I think. That's the key, isn't it? And, you know, if you have a season where your international players are missing for a third of it, you know, unless you have a deep squad like Saracens used to have, you can't compete.
I feel it looks a little bit like we've bought our title this season, if that's the way it goes. But, you know, everyone has to buy a squad from somewhere, but that's how it looks to me.
Let's move on to our regular god or goddess of the week. Owen, you've obviously decided that Dave Rogers deserves to be god of the week for that wonderful photo
explain who Dave Rogers is. I mean, he has been on this podcast before, but he's the best known rugby photographer in the world. He's certainly covered international and club rugby since what was his first Lions tour? I think he did 1980. No, actually, he did the 70s. He's that old. He's really old.
Yeah, I remember telling stories of having to literally post rolls of film back to the UK for them to be developed from Lions tours in New Zealand. So.
Yeah. So anyway, he's got that amazing picture of the French prop smacking Jamie Ritchie on the nose for which he received his red card. It's not only a great picture, but it's the news picture of the day as well. So it sort of does two jobs in one go. So well done, Dave.
Alex, have you got any contenders for your God or Goddess of the Week?
I'm going to stay in the media too. I'm going to give my God of the Week to Alistair Reid, our colleague from the Times Scottish rugby correspondent, purely for the piece he wrote last week, giving an absolute savaging to the executives who are running rugby and questioning their motives and questioning whether we should be trusting them to make the right decisions and when there are financial bonuses available to these executives, should they be the ones entrusted to make the right decisions for the future of rugby?
Good call.
It's about trust. You know, the RFU are in a position where nobody trusts what they say at the moment. The Six Nations have apparently done a U-turn on pay TV. It's about trust. And Alistair wrote a brilliant piece, which I thought summed up exactly where we are at the moment in the professional game. So Alistair gets my nod.
My God of the Week, slightly closer to home and somewhat one-eyed, but Lee Blackett of Wasps has done an outstanding job for the last 3 weeks. And whatever he's done or whatever he said seems to have worked. And he's breathed fire back into a Wasps team that was ailing in 11th and are now up to the heady heights of 5th in the Gallagher Premiership.
Can I have a second nomination, just quickly? And it's not myself, right? So I also like to nominate Carl Sinclair. And the reason being, one of the sort of the conversations during the Six Nations, and particularly around England, is around personalities and what is a good personality in the game, what isn't, and when it's good to talk and be entertaining or vent your opinion when it's not. And Carl Sinclair is held back from getting involved in that, which has been frustrating because we in the rugby media think he's fantastic. But he came out after the game. There's a lovely piece with him in the Times today that Alex wrote. But he was talking about what rugby's done for him, how he's had to change the way he approaches life because he was a hothead last year, and he just represents himself really well. And he comes over like the sort of as the sort of rugby person that you want on any post around the country, going, "This is what your kid could be like. This is what rugby does." He just represents himself and the game really well, that's aside from all the stuff he does on the pitch, which I think he's had a pretty damn good Six Nations too. So I've come up with two nominations.
Okay, Dave, you're relegated now. It's Carl Sinclair. My thanks to Owen Slott, Alex Lowe. The Ruck is back next Monday. Make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe now via Acast, iTunes, or your preferred podcast provider.